From Inside Higher Ed, this is This Week at Inside Higher Ed, the informed and essential conversation about the week's news in higher education. This Week is made possible through the generous support of our sponsors, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, Oracle, and 2U.
Greetings from This Week at Inside Higher Ed. The Obama administration wants to talk about sexual assault on campus. Faculty at the University of Chicago oppose Chinese money for a Confucius Institute. Google promises not to read your campus email anymore. And do we really need campus policies about selfies at graduation? Hi, I'm Casey Green, the moderator for This Week at Inside Higher Ed, where we go behind and beyond the news to provide the informative and engaging conversation about what really matters in higher education. Our panelists today are Judith Shapiro, President and Professor Emerita of Barnard College and the current President of the Teagle Foundation. Ben Vidalsky is the Director of Higher Education Studies at the Rockefeller Institute of Government and a policy professor at SUNY Albany. And Scott Jasek is the co-founder and co-editor of Inside Higher Ed. Panel, welcome to you all. Ahead of the conversation, please note you can post your comments on the comments section of the This Week page at insidehighered.com/thisweek. Let's go to the headlines for our conversation today. The Obama administration announces plans to address sexual abuse on campus following some very public comments and complaints regarding the failure of elite institutions to address incidents of sexual abuse. The White House earlier this week provided new guidance about the reach of Title IX compliance as part of an aggressive effort to combat sexual assault on campus. Upping the ante, yesterday on Thursday afternoon, the Department of Ed released a list of 55 institutions that are under review for how these campuses handle complaints of sexual assault and harassment. Scott, set the stage for us. What's the backstory here? What's really important in this initiative from the White House?
Sure. I think there are three things that have come together right now. One is a number of the cases have become public in which it appears that colleges seriously dropped the ball on allegations that were brought to their attention. And in some cases, they may have even actively protected those accused, particularly athletes or other individuals of influence. Two, you have women going public. It's important to say that sexual assault is not a new problem, but in a previous era, women may have been less likely to report or speak out. Now they are reporting, they are speaking out in very public ways, drawing attention. The other thing is I think there's a lot of scrutiny right now of campus judicial systems that were designed to maybe police plagiarism or academic disputes that many think are in over their heads when handling sexual assault allegations.
Great, thank you. Judith, so you're a former college president, and we should add you're the former president of a women's college. What's your take on this initiative? And as you think about your conversations with your colleagues, and particularly your former presidential colleagues, what do you think their response is to this initiative from the White House?
Well, first of all, since you mentioned my experience with women's colleges, I'll just note that none of them is on the list. But leaving that aside, I think that Scott made the best or most relevant point about whether universities and colleges are really equipped to handle very serious matters that are, in fact, violent crimes, which is what rape is, and it should be handled by our criminal justice system. Students, I think, should be told very clearly that they cannot be and will not be protected by their college if they commit a rape and if a case is brought against them. If a victim, and there's also the issue of protecting the privacy of victims if they want that, if a victim wants not to bring a case, then I think the college certainly can offer as much support as possible for that person, but warning the person that she or he will not be able to get the justice they might want. Also, certainly, I think there need to be strong consequences for students in cases that are less serious and not most appropriate for the justice system. But, you know, colleges cannot function either as criminal courts or, if we want to get in later to the issue of drugs, as rehab centers for serious addiction problems.
Ben, advocates will say this is not enough, and critics will say it's way too much in terms of an overreach on Title IX. What's your take? I mean, will others welcome it? Will they endorse it?
Well, I mean, look, I think there are, you know, perhaps it goes without saying, lots of very tough issues here. I think the White House, you could certainly say it has a lot of PR value, but then what does it really mean to be under investigation? You know, just a couple of examples that I've seen in Inside Higher Ed suggest, you know, an incident that happened a year and a half ago led to a complaint from a student that it was not properly adjudicated, and the college is just now trying to figure it out. You know, you could say, well, that shows you the college has been shown to be negligent, or it may just show you that perhaps an allegation does not equal an offense. I mean, one of the difficult things here is you have to be responsive to allegations. The sexual assault, rape are tremendously serious issues, but you also have to maintain the presumption of innocence. I mean, we cannot forget the Duke lacrosse scandal. That, of course, got into the criminal system very quickly. I think in terms of what the White House can do, I think that there was a very interesting one-minute public service announcement about both rape prevention and also bystander intervention, which is getting a lot of attention with Steve Carell and Seth Meyers and some other actors, but also alcohol abuse. It's massively correlated with sexual assault. I think this is fundamentally about campus drinking culture. It's a pernicious problem. I'm not sure what the White House can do there, but that may be a case where the bully pulpit could also be used in a helpful way.
Judith, let me come back to you. You made a very strong statement about these matters should be handled through the criminal process as opposed to campus processes. That's a major switch for virtually all institutions in the United States. Would you go a little deeper on that?
Well, when I said these problems, I really meant a problem that is clearly a case of rape. And I think Ben has used a very key word, and that is the culture of these institutions. And I think in addition to whatever formal processes one should have for various kinds of misbehavior, short of truly criminal misbehavior, I think it's also important for institutions to really do good research. And here part of the issue is what kinds of surveys should there be. And I think good surveys, I mean, after all, institutions are about conducting research, among other things. There have, in fact, been a couple of anthropologists who've done field work on college campuses, and that can give you another perspective on things in addition to surveys, which, of course, have to be well-designed and intelligently interpreted. But I do believe that culture change is very important. And in addition to formal procedures, there are all kinds of time-honored traditional ways to show disapproval, students to other students, faculty to students, you know, contempt, disgust, being grossed out, ostracism. And I think that when people who violate the norms we want to see among students feel like outcasts, that will help very much. Also, I think it's very important to hear men talk out about this, not just mm-hmm. as victims, but also as what they think proper behavior, dignified behavior, strong behavior should be between men and women.
Scott, let me bring you back into this conversation. Inside Higher Ed covers a lot about campus culture, lots of articles over time about the issue of drinking on campus. Ben mentioned that drinking is often very closely correlated, associated with these incidents of sexual assault. What do you see and what do you hear going on campus in terms of user education, student education, as it relates to both alcohol and sexual assault?
Well, in terms of sexual assault, one of the key issues, and this is where the bully pulpit may have an impact, is the importance of immediate reporting. There's much more that a local police force can do if a sexual assault is reported right away, not later. And so the talking about the need to report something immediately matters. And then the issue that I think Ben mentioned about bystander intervention. There is, and many campuses, a culture of not intervening. And that's not just about sexual assault. That's about people who are drinking beyond a point where they can be safe and healthy. And the idea that it's not uncool to intervene and say, hey, can I walk you home, is a really important shift at a lot of campuses. And we're seeing places try to bring about those cultural shifts.
Well, Scott, again, as somebody who monitors the environment broadly, does some of this suggest the return to some variation on what many of us recall from decades ago as in loco parentis, a more active role on the part of institutions?
I tend to think in loco parentis style things won't work. In fact, What we're seeing is some colleges create peer groups where peers, where students are going to parties with the idea of looking who's in trouble. And I think they may have much more impact than sending in an assistant dean of students who's going to be laughed at or ignored. I think students naturally rebel against authority, and particularly authority telling them how they can have fun. And so I think peer education and peer intervention may be key to this, along with obviously tough enforcement when people, sexual assault, as Judith said, is a crime and needs to be treated as a crime, not as, students will be students.
But can I jump in there?
Sure, Dan, Ben, please.
I think this is something that merits further investigation. Maybe Scott will want to run some stories on this if you haven't. I think there's an interesting issue here, which is do people who would consider themselves advocates for women on campus, do they actually want the criminal justice system involved? My sense, I'm not an expert on this, is that this has been an area where they're not that keen to have the criminal justice system involved because it is so hard to get convictions. But so paradoxically, then, you have these incidents are then adjudicated on campus by what one professor termed something like the volunteer fire department, which is the sort of judicial boards that are internal to the campus. And, of course, they can't send anyone to jail. And they also may have penalties like, we'll send the guy away for a semester. Well, the woman may be immensely dissatisfied with that outcome. So I think that where it gets adjudicated, it's an interesting question to ask advocates as to what they really want.
May I add to what Ben has just said?
Please.
In fact, that points up the difference between this situation and that in the military, and some people have been making a comparison. In the military, the situation is really how much should be left to the chain of command or not. And anyone who thinks there's a chain of command in an academic setting hasn't spent any amount of time there. So yeah. I believe that indeed what Ben has said is exactly right. Leaving it to colleges to adjudicate what are, in fact, criminal offenses is never going to have a good outcome.
Scott, I sense you want to get in on this comment as well.
Yes. Per what Ben was saying, I think a lot of campus advocates for women do, and this is very appropriate, talk to women about what may happen if a process gets public and goes through the system. And historically, there have actually been terrible treatment of women who report rape and sexual assault. My thinking is that some of that has gotten better in local police, but no doubt that's still a problem. And so they're warning them about that, and that may encourage some of them not to go to the police. And that's when you have this cycle. The question I would ask those who discourage from going to the police is, if someone got shot in a campus dormitory, no one would say, hey, do you want to handle this internally or externally? It would be treated as a violent crime. And the reality is most campuses aren't well suited to look at violent crime. Investigations of rape and sexual assault now have physical evidence. They shouldn't be just he said, she said, which is what I fear they many times are in a campus judicial system.
Judith, I want to give you the last comment on this topic. You mentioned research a few moments ago. One of the very prominent features of the initiative is a campus climate survey to look at issues about a climate for assault, sexual harassment, other issues. Both your professional hats as a former college president, as an anthropologist by training. What's your assessment about this initiative? Valerie Jarrett was on some of the cable networks earlier this week. She's the senior White House advisor. She described it initially as a voluntary survey, but one that will ultimately go mandatory if the administration is able to move as it would like to. Will a survey like this work? How is it different than, for example, the kind of the reporting required by the Clery Act about actual crimes as opposed to campus climate?
Well, I think, first of all, there's the question of will it be an intelligent, thoughtful survey, because you can't really speak about surveys generally. Some are terrible, some are good. Then the question is how will the surveys be used? Will they be surveys just for external accountability, or will they be the kind of surveys that are geared towards being able to change behavior on the campus itself? And I think that that really should be the most important function. It should be a kind of institutional consciousness raising so that people, all members of the community, become aware of things that they may not have realized and start thinking about how to change.
Great. All right, let's shift a little bit. Let's talk about money, specifically money from the Chinese government for Confucius Institutes. The faculty at the University of Chicago have called upon campus officials to cancel a contract with Heban, which is the Chinese government organization that oversees the centers that promote Chinese language teaching and research, specifically the Confucius Centers. Faculty opponents at Chicago argue that the Chinese money would exercise significant influence over who's teaching at Chicago and what's taught under both the university's logo and in its curricula. This issue, by the way, is not about launching a Confucius Center, but about renewing an existing contract for another 5 years. Judith, again, I'm going to turn to you as a president. What's the real issue here? Is it money from China? Is it the fact that the administration did the deal without faculty engagement and consultation? Give us your thoughts.
Well, I think it's about many things. Certainly, there's an issue of academic freedom. And I take those issues very seriously. It happens that I'm a member of the board of Scholars at Risk, which is a nonprofit devoted specifically to the issue of academic freedom, both in providing support and help to individual scholars who've been victims and also just getting the word out on the significance of academic freedom. So that is certainly an issue. Then there's also the issue of should one make secret agreements about academic programs, and should the faculty or which faculty not have a say in that. Now, on the question of which faculty, I think here, and maybe this is something we can discuss at greater length, and also something IHE might want to write more about, is this issue of governance. That is, here we have someone saying, or a group of faculty saying, even if the department wants it, and perhaps they want it because they're afraid of alienating the government, which would endanger their research, is that good enough, or should the faculty as a whole weigh in? Well, if the faculty as a whole are going to take certain, have certain rights, what responsibilities should they have that they may not have taken up yet? So I see the this as a very important occasion to talk about faculty governance.
Ben, let me turn to you about sort of the significance of the Chicago decision and what the Inside Higher Ed article described as potentially an inferred or implied endorsement. If Chicago does it, it gives us runway at other institutions to pursue these agreements. I mean, does the agreement that an elite institution like Chicago make with, say, for example, the Chinese government, or accepting money from somebody at various points on the political spectrum, right wing or left wing, does that cast a shadow, or does it provide clearance for others to pursue these agreements as well?
Well, I guess there's a lot to be said here. I mean, one point is just sort of generically, you know, anything like this, you know, raises the prospect of, you know, should you or can you have the Krispy Kreme Center for Nutritional Science? You know, are you able to pursue what universities are about, the unfettered search for the truth, right? That's fundamentally, that's just core to the mission. And if you are in bed one way or another with a government or an institution or an industry that is going to make that hard, I think it's probably unacceptable. It is unacceptable. Now, having said that, and to your specific question, there's already around 70 Confucius Institutes around the country at a wide range of places, both elite institutions and non-elite institutions. So it's, yeah, I suppose one could say, of course, Chicago, as Scott said, this is a renewal, I think, of an initial five-year contract. So it's not something that's brand new. I suppose you could say it might harden other institutions that are considering this or considering renewals because it's U of Chicago. It's a very prestigious place. But I think fundamentally, you know, people are going to do this if it seems like a good deal to them. And then they have an interest in China. They have an interest in Chinese language. Someone is coming and saying, we'll give you not a huge amount of money, but a decent amount of money. Plus, we'll supply, you know, we'll pay for travel and I think salaries for a bunch of Chinese language instructors, for example. I think that's really the attraction. And the question, I think, always is going to be, you know, obviously this is China. It's not exactly a beacon of liberal democracy. Are universities and colleges going to be able to pursue what they want to do unfettered despite the involvement of China? And I think so far many of them will argue that they have been able to do that, that they have been able to have, you know, talks about Taiwan, that kind of thing, and that they have not had interference. But clearly there's, I think it's a reasonable concern on the other side.
Scott, what's the backstory here that we're missing? I mean, is it does China sort of elevate this as opposed to, if we were looking at it on a political spectrum, money from the Koch brothers at one end or George Soros on the other, or, as Ben suggested, the Krispy Kreme Center for Nutritional Research?
Well, there's always concern about, are there strings attached to grants to colleges and universities? Now, I think if you look at the programming at Confucius Institutes, you're not going to see a lot of, you know, seminars on why, Taiwan is bad or whatever. But what you do see, and this is something we've written about, is a lot of portrayals of China in a very benign way, like, let's look at Chinese calligraphy, let's look at Chinese dance. Nothing wrong with that, but at a time that many colleges and universities should probably be looking at China as a world economic and military power, looking at Chinese democracy or lack thereof, this sets a very different sort of agenda. And there's a lot of concern about self-censorship of institutions that are seeking Chinese money. Do they encourage certain kinds of programs? China actually seems to be very adept at what is called, you know, what people call soft power, mm-hmm. and that's what they're doing with this.
Judith, I know that you had some thoughts about this in terms of what an alternative path might have been in this negotiation and the collaboration, in terms of thinking about curriculum, in terms of thinking about hiring. Again, well, as a college president, but also as a scholar, take us down that path.
Well, one issue that hasn't come up yet in the conversation in connection with the fact that there are more and less prestigious institutions hosting these things, what has come up in the reporting is that places like Chicago, Columbia, or Stanford can cut a deal with the Chinese government or with these institutes that is minimally, if at all, restrictive, whereas others cannot. And that's something to be looked into, in which case these high-prestige institutions have the role of enablers. Now, you know, I'm not taking a totally purist approach to what kinds of foreign arrangements we might be able to have, because we also want to engage with other countries. But, I do think that we have to be very careful about what's going on specifically. And in this case, in terms of who makes decisions, as you asked, if it's going to be a matter of foregoing an arrangement that is bringing significant funds into the institution, what are the faculty going to face in terms of responsibilities for deciding, is Asian studies a major priority for the University of Chicago? And if it isn't, what other financial arrangements might have to be made to make it so? So in other words, departments will have to stop operating like feudal entities and really begin to think about their responsibilities to the institution as a whole.
But Scott, doesn't this have the potential to pit departments against one another?
Absolutely, and I'd like to go back.
Our money for our project, and what do you know about our relationships and our research funding? Do you want us meddling in what you're doing?
Well, and I'd go back to what Judith said earlier about, does the department decide or does the entire faculty decide? And this goes way beyond Confucius Institutes to things like some of the new distance education relationships. At colleges that have let entire faculties review the various proposals, I think there have been more public no's to the options before them, because frequently a proposal may benefit an individual department, but other faculty may feel it doesn't help higher education or the institution as a whole, and that it raises these tough issues. And then the flip side of this is what Judith said about who is going to support whatever this program is. The reality is, you look throughout any college or university, and college and university administrators and faculty are doing all kinds of things to get money, and they're hoping they can do them in ways that don't compromise academic values. But these issues are very tricky, and part of what really stands out to me at Chicago is Chicago has great Asian studies. They didn't need a Confucius Institute to be strong in this field. Many other places don't have much and should, so it's more difficult for them.
Great. Scott, thank you. And you mentioned two words would give us an easy transition to our next topic, money and academic values. Google announced this week it would stop reading campus email. Data from the annual campus computing survey revealed that over the past 6 or 7 years, upwards of 80% of campuses across the country have accepted the offer from either Google or Microsoft to host campus email services for free. Certainly in a time of financial stress, this looked to be a really good deal, outsourcing campus email to a third party at little or no cost. But interestingly, while the campuses are clearly willing to cede student email to Google or Microsoft, many institutions still maintain their own email services for faculty and staff. As noted in the story that ran in the Thursday edition, May 1st at Inside Higher Ed, Google makes its living on the information it can learn from its users, which can then be served back to them and sponsors in the forms of targeted ads. Many on campus view this to be, in part, Faustian pact and potentially an illegal agreement, and that Google scans email for keywords and content, even as Google asserts it's not interested in what's in my email. It wants to aggregate everyone's email. Again, Google said it would no longer do this. Ben, let me tune it to you on this one. Many of us have private Gmail accounts. You know, in our private lives, we want to separate our campus accounts as opposed to our acme.edu accounts. Should we be concerned about what this sort of carryover? Is this a big deal, or is this much ado about nothing?
Well, I mean, look, when I look at this stuff, one of the first reactions I still have, you know, is, wow, they can do that? You know, it's, I mean, technologically, I think it's kind of extraordinary. On the other hand, it can be incredibly annoying, and it can be sort of creepy, you know, when you start seeing ads or on my AOL, or rather on my Facebook, I'm not sure where they come from, but I see targeted ads that seem to be based on, you know, online purchases I've made at, you know, at Land's End or whatever. But I guess I think it's certainly in our private lives, it's one of those things that many of us put up with as the price of entry. You know, we do have this kind of technology, you know, big brother way of life that for many of us, certainly to me, seems pretty benign. Even if there's an option, let's say, to turn off the ads, I've certainly never bothered to figure it out and to look at it, even though I find them irritating. I think in the case of campuses, you know, a big issue is just whether people are giving their informed consent. You know, I don't know the ins and outs of the law here. Obviously, Google's worried about getting sued. But I think that if you understand that being scanned, having your messages scanned for these aggregate use for ads is the price of entry, it just doesn't seem so horrible to me.
Judith, there's a clear dual track here. At least the data that I collect as part of the annual campus computing survey clearly indicate that many campuses are very happy to cede student email to third parties, Google and Microsoft. We know, for example, from Student Monitor that the typical full-time undergraduate has 3.2 email addresses, one his or her parents may know and a couple that they keep for other purposes. And yet, again, going back to the campus computing survey data, far fewer institutions are willing to turn over faculty and administrative email to Google or Microsoft. They continue to maintain a separate infrastructure. Does that seem appropriate if we're asking our students or sending our students in one direction and we're keeping a different infrastructure for faculty and administrators?
Well, actually, in the case I know best, which is Barnard College, Barnard as an institution became a Google institutional client, which means that all of the email of all the communities, students, faculty, administrators, are on this kind of Gmail dot, it's an EDU address, and when you do that as an institution with Google, you also, you know, pay for it and get support. I think a general question here is that the online environment has made us tend to expect a free lunch, even those of us who can afford to pay for lunch. And so since there is no truly free lunch, as Ben was pointing out, what the price is advertising. What the deal is, you know, you kind of toss away your privacy. And how benign that is, I don't really know, but I certainly always found as an administrator and as a teacher that I tried to encourage students, particularly in the current environment, to value privacy.
You know, this is not the first time we've had issues about privacy with Internet providers. There was a brouhaha about 2 years ago in terms of what was going on in browsers scanning your activity. Famously, Scott McNeely, the president and co-founder of Sun Microsystems, said about a decade ago that you might as well forget about privacy on the Internet, just get over it. But in the context of the Google agreement specifically with institutions, is there not a potential downside here if Google stops scanning campus email? Clearly, as the article indicated yesterday, the value for Google is they get all this data and they can do keyword searches. if Google's no longer doing it, presumably some value in that relationship is lost. Google might have reason to say, you know what, we're out of here. Let's terminate the agreement, or let's change the terms of the agreement and start charging for this, which means campuses, once again, will incur substantial costs for at least student email. What's the risk?
That is a risk, but I actually wouldn't underestimate Google's ability to come up with other ways to monetize what they're doing. If you look at, say, Google has faced bumps in the road on their Books project and various other things, and they're a big enough organization that they seem to go with the attitude of, if we get pushback here, we'll come up with another way. If they don't come up with another way to monetize it, I think the risk you say is real, but I'm guessing they're going to figure out some other approach to profit from it. And then the task for colleges and for privacy advocates will be to ask, does that approach violate our norms, violate our privacy, or not?
Speaking of violating norms, let's go to our last story. What's wrong with a selfie at graduation? It's May, graduation season is upon us, and in the past that, of course, meant family and friends jockeying for position in front of podiums as the candidate walked across the stage and received the handshake and a degree or an empty folder waiting for the degree to arrive. Some campuses, as reported by Inside Higher Ed, have put a ban on selfies, presumably, again, students stopping for the handshake with the dean or the president who's handing out the degree. Others have said, you know what, this is a good thing, we want to celebrate and we want to encourage it. Judith, you're the one member of our panel who's actually been on the podium in terms of handing out degrees. What's your take, A or nay, on selfies as students are walking across?
Well, actually, the way this was done, both when I graduated many, many, many decades ago and at Barnard, is you had a professional photographer right up there taking truly excellent, good quality photographs of each graduate. This somewhat controlled the hysterical parent situation. As far as selfies are concerned, I happen to pretty much be repelled not only by the concept but by the word itself. And I do think the world would be a far, far better place if more of us just got over ourselves.
Ben, has the technology gotten ahead of us once again in terms of what we can do as opposed to what we should do? It speaks to large issues of etiquette. It comes back to the last conversation about our understanding of privacy and the culture of the Internet and what goes on campus.
Well, look, I mean, I think we have to pick and choose our battles. I mean, the technology divide, even between, 28-year-olds and 20-year-olds is significant. People are just doing this. I have two sort of conflicting reactions, which is, one, lighten up. This is the reality. People are going to have fun with it. That's just this, by no means the worst thing that kids that age could be doing. And number two, part of the rationale for getting rid of it was that it slowed everything down at the graduation ceremony. And I feel, having gone through, umpteen, elementary, middle school, high school graduations, anything you can do to shorten the length of these ceremonies, please do it. And if that means getting rid of selfies, great.
Yeah, all right. Scott, your thoughts as we close on this topic?
Well, what I think is good here is that the universities are actually talking about it. We write all the time about faculty who are driven mad by students who send them emails that don't even use their name, but just say, hey, and then assume that that's an appropriate greeting, or who expect an answer at 3 a.m., or who overshare, or whatever. And we write a lot more stories about faculty complaining about students than anybody saying, hey, students, here's why we don't like that practice. Can we talk about it? And I think, given the generational splits that Ben mentioned, the way forward is to actually talk, not just complain.
Great. Thank you. Panel, I want to give you a last opportunity for a final comment. Very quickly, what have we missed in the news this week, or what should we attend to next week or even beyond next week that deserves our attention? Judith, let me begin with you.
Well, I can't think of anything offhand that was a big, important story this week that was missed, but I think it would be of interest in the future to give some serious attention and analysis to issues of governance and of campus culture.
Ben, last thought?
Sure. Well, I guess there's a little sleeper issue, if you can call it a sleeper, after it's been in the New York Times. Last week, David Leonhard, who just has a new venture through the Times called The Upshot, wrote a very thoughtful piece about the idea that admission selectivity at the Ivies and elite schools is driven in part in recent years by the growth of international students. And now I worry about this leading to scapegoating of foreign students for all the anxiety we have around admissions. And I'm not certain about all of the data, but, you know, I think that it's interesting because he actually really attaches it to the growth of a number of recruited groups, legacies, underrepresented minorities, and athletes, possibly coming at the expense of first-generation and low-income students who have not received the same kind of recruiting priority at elite schools.
Great, thank you. And Scott, final comment?
So I actually see an interesting commonality between the issues we discussed today, and that is that colleges are getting more and more scrutiny, and colleges can't expect that their judicial systems, their deals with foreign countries, their email contracts are just going to be accepted because they're colleges and they say they're a good thing. We're in an era of scrutiny for higher ed.
Yes, good point. All right, well, great. Panel, thank you. My thanks to Judith Shapiro, Ben Vidalsky, and Scott Jasek for joining us today, and our thanks to you, the audience, for joining us for this first edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is available as an audio stream or a downloadable podcast beginning at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on most Fridays. On the web, we are available at insidehighered.com/thisweek. And please share your comments with us about the This Week program on the comments section of the This Week webpage. Thank you.
Join us for the next edition of This Week at Inside Higher Ed. Funding for This Week is provided by 2U, ACT, Barnes & Noble College, Intel Corporation, Lumina Foundation, and Oracle. This Week at Inside Higher Ed is a production of G2 Education. Executive producer is Ginny Goldstein. Technical support is provided by Learning Times.